Hello, my name's Adrian Goldberg. Thank you for downloading the 5 Live Investigates podcast. This week, the home heating systems, which should be cheap and green, but which have been plagued by outages and which residents say has left them with large bills. Also on the programme, a huge increase in the number of tool thefts from tradesmen's vans. Thanks to a skeleton key, anyone can buy online for 20 quid. How about this for an offer? A neighbourhood energy project that promises cheaper heating and hot water for you and your neighbours, and which is good for the environment. Who could say no to that? But 5 Live investigators found that some district heating schemes, which are actively promoted by the government and are used by nearly a quarter of a million of people, are beset with problems. The idea is a simple one. You create all the heat and hot water you need for a housing estate in one centralised and highly efficient plant, rather than relying on every property to have its own separate and sometimes inefficient boiler. Saves money and waste. That's the theory. Residents on one estate, though, have been telling us about their reality, which involves huge bills and being left without heating and hot water. So we'd love to hear your experiences of district heating this morning, good and bad. You can text us on 85058, tweet at BBC5Live, email goldberg at bbc.co.uk, or on Facebook, we're at BBC Radio 5 Live. Our story begins at the Myattsfield North Estate in Lambeth in South London, which has nearly 1,000 flats and houses. Some are let by the council, others are privately owned. A regeneration scheme began in 2012, and it included the installation of a district heating system powered by a central plant known as the Submarine, run by the energy company E.ON. Resident Amaka Okafor gave me a tour of her estate.
So we're on the Myattsfield North, now newly crowned the Oval Quarters, new build developments. And we're about to go onto Ackerman Road, where the dreaded district heating system is, which gives so many people problems.
We've just arrived now at the place that is known locally as the Submarine, and I can see exactly why. It's a long, thin, grey concrete structure with two towers rising out of it and a stubby black door. Now, along with Amaka, Duncan Fawkes has come with us to see this place known as the Submarine. Duncan, you're a consultant on what's known as district heating. Just tell us how it's supposed to work.
Inside this building will be boilers which generates heat, and this heat will be sent by pipes round to all the houses, all the flats. And in each flat, every customer can take the heat they need for their heating or for their hot water from the system.
The idea of a district heating system like this then is what? That everybody on this estate should be able to enjoy low-cost, efficient heating?
Yes, cost should be low. But the other aspect is about global warming. This kind of system, if it's designed and implemented properly, should reduce carbon dioxide emissions as well.
So, Amaka, what have people been saying to you about the district heating system?
There have been occasions where they've had no hot water or heating without warning. They're concerned about the estimated bills that are very high.
I'm a bit puzzled by this whole issue of people having to rely on estimates. Isn't the whole point of a smart meter that details of your energy consumption are passed direct to the energy company so they know how much energy you've used?
One of the reasons that's been conveyed by E.ON is that there's signalling issues. The framework of the new builds is of metal, and that's interfering with the receiving of the signals.
The metal construction flats and the houses themselves gets in the way of the messages being sent back to the energy company.
Absolutely.
There has been concern, I know, about the death of one resident on the estate, Edward Connell, who died from heart failure towards the end of last year.
Yes, in July he actually came to one of our resident meetings and had raised some concerns. He was actually trying to move away from the estate because he couldn't manage the bills at all. He couldn't understand the temperatures. He couldn't understand why he was getting high estimated bills. A resident did tell me he was walking around with his bag of bills, contacting Ian all the time for help, and he didn't feel that he was being supported. So that was the reason why he'd wanted to move away.
But people on the estate believe that he was making that choice of heating or eating, and he was choosing to heat his flat and going without food.
That's the belief of many of the residents. And, I mean, there are lots of residents that are in similar situations where they do not put their heating on at all. They go to bed early. There's one particular resident, I've actually brought her blankets and fleece sheets because she doesn't want to put her heating on because she's so distressed about the bills.
Now, we've come a little deeper into the estate now to Sharon's house, and Sharon has had a very particular problem with her billing. Sharon, hello.
Hi.
It's Adrian from Five Live.
Hello.
How are you? You're right.
Okay. Welcome.
This was the £22.82, then this was the one they sent in May. Then that week, they sent this. Then they sent the big one.
Wow, £1,099.48 for 1 month's heating and hot water. What did you think when that arrived at your doormat?
It's not a hotel, this is a private home with, like, it's two children and myself that lives here. I mean, I cannot use so much hot water or heating for that matter. I still owe them an outstanding bill of £1,000. Why should I pay for something I haven't used?
Now, as we've been walking round the estate, word of our visit has reached some of the neighbours. Jan has come out to have a word with us. How has it been for you?
It's been awful. I've just got off the phone to them now. The bill's £183 in 1 month. So they want me now to write out a meter reading every day at the same time for 7 days and get back to them.
What would it normally be?
About 40, 50 or something like that.
So it sort of quadrupled in 1 month?
It has, yes.
Now, Tina, you're vice chair of the Residents Association, and you've had your own personal problems with the heating system as well.
Yes, when I first moved in, they seemed to be able to read my meter for 2 years. That stopped in December of last year. All of a sudden, they couldn't read my meter, and they started sending me 100 and odd pound, 90 pound estimated bills.
So how much had you been paying on the accurate readings?
On average, for the use of the hot water, it's about 20, 21 pounds a month.
Did you query this with Eon?
They apologised, but since then, they just keep on sending me overestimated bills. There are people on this estate, they are choosing between heating and eating because the bill is too expensive. When they was procuring the contract, it was going to better our lives. It was going to be kinder to the environment, cost effective. No, that is not the experience.
How would you sum up this scheme?
It needs to be torn down and started all over again. We're left with E.ON for 40 years.
That's the length of the contract.
That's the length of the contract. We was told 25 years originally, and then it got extended to 40 years. I don't even want to have 40 minutes longer with E.ON, let alone 40 years.
There you go. That's Tina, one of the unhappy E.ON customers on the Myattsfield North Estate, now rebranded the Oval Quarter in South London, telling me about some of the issues they've been facing since the installation of what's known as district heating. Dr. Stuart Hodkinson is from the University of Leeds, author of a report into the issues facing residents at Myattsfield. Tell me exactly, Stuart, how district heating is supposed to work. I've tried to give my gloss on it, but in layman's terms, what should happen here?
Yeah, good morning, Adrian.
Morning.
So in theory, district heating replaces the need for every home to have their own gas boiler or electric heater for heating and hot water. Instead, heat is produced by like a nearby energy centre, which could be using gas or biomass boilers, and it could be using waste heat from electricity production or even the London Underground, and that is then sent back into individual homes via insulated pipes. So this has the potential to be much more efficient than using your own gas boilers, and it can reduce carbon emissions at the same time, which helps to tackle fuel poverty and climate change. So it's a good thing in theory.
And it's not an entirely new idea, is it? I mean, I grew up in some council flats in Birmingham, and we had a centralised boiler that was coal-powered, so not particularly good for combating climate change, but where everybody's heating was run off the same centralised system. But there is a new and re-energised push for this now from central government.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, people listening to your show right now will be probably connected to a district heating network of one kind or another, and the government wants to grow these by about 8% every year to 2050. It's launched a £320 million fund, which will support about 200 new district heating networks by 2021. And the Mayor of London is pushing to get district heating into as many new developments as possible in London. And local authorities across the country are also now starting to think about developing new municipal heat schemes.
And you've looked quite specifically at Myattsfield. What's happened there? What's gone wrong for so many of the residents?
Well, I think pretty much everything in the district heating system that E.ON has installed has gone wrong since the beginning. First homes were connected in January 2013, and over the past 4 years, there's been problems with this intermittent hot water, so temperatures sometimes go tepid or freezing cold when you're in the shower. The district heating itself has broken down on about 48 separate occasions, which leaves residents without hot water and heating for hours, days, sometimes weekends. You've even got households, because of faults with their internal heating units and a very poor repair service, they've gone without heating or hot water for weeks, months, and in some cases more than a year. And I think E.ON has failed to properly compensate some of those residents. It's refused to accept liability for some of the faults. It's blamed those on other contractors. But the biggest single problem has been the billing, as you heard in the start of your programme. The smart meters that are supposed to get an accurate usage of consumption per month so that no one pays any estimated bills, they failed because of all the technological problems with them. So some residents get very high estimated bills every month, and then they have to fight to get E.ON to accept their readings. And this is very, very stressful. And because you get fined £10 for late payment, many feel pressured to pay bills they don't owe.
Is there any one single cause for this, or is there a range of factors behind these failures?
Partly it's technical, but I think it's more about the fact that you've got a long-term 40-year contract. There's no competition here for provision. It's a PFI scheme, which makes it even more complicated. You've got lots of different contractors who are partly responsible, but no one's overall accountable. And, you've got homeowners, for example, who are paying big whopping service charges. So there's a whole range of problems going on, but I think the lack of regulation and the kind of the big money that's been invested in and the need to get a big return from a relatively small group of residents is kind of what underpins it all.
Yeah, we're going to address this in more detail a little later on, but I think many listeners who have their own energy suppliers, have their own boiler in their own house, and who, if they don't like the charges or don't like the service, can switch energy provider, will be astonished to hear that if you're part of a district heating scheme, even if you don't like the bills or you don't like the company, you can't just change.
No, they can't change. They are locked in for the next 35 years. And I think they're probably going to be locked in for another 35 years after that. I think they've got this scheme for life because the contract has been negotiated to give E.ON a monopoly of heat and hot water of the residents of this estate. So, you know, many pre-existing residents didn't know much about this because of poor consultation by the local authority. We've seen evidence that new homeowners, when they bought flats on the estate, were effectively, I think, missold some of these flats because there was very little information about this energy monopoly they were buying into. And I've been checking the prices on the market, and every resident on Mansfield North could access a better energy deal right now if they were able to switch, but the PFI contract forbids it.
You have written a highly critical report. What have Ian had to say to you in response to it?
So E.ON saw a draft of this report a while ago, and they, you know, came back and apologised to all residents. They've accepted that the service has not been acceptable, and they have committed to improve their customer service, to upgrade the smart meters, and they're also being audited by the Heat Trust, which is a voluntary regulatory body they belong to. But unfortunately, E.ON has so far refused residents' requests for a working group to review its prices and compensation offer, and we wanted to see like an independent technical audit of the district heating to make sure that it is working everywhere. But for me, until this industry is properly regulated, until planning controls are put in place to ensure that a 40-year energy monopoly delivers for residents, not just big business, I think these problems are going to continue.
Stuart, for now, thank you. That's Dr. Stuart Hodgkinson from Leeds University. The time now is 11:18.
Across the UK, this is BBC Five Live. Five Live investigates.
Now, this morning on Five Live Investigates, we're talking about district heating schemes. These are used to provide energy to thousands of homes across the UK. And the idea is that heat and hot water for a group of flats and houses is provided from a centralised plant rather than householders having individual and sometimes inefficient boilers. And when it works as it's meant to, you get cheaper heating bills and it's good for the environment. But we've discovered that some district heating networks have left residents without heat and hot water, and they're saying they're paying much more than if they had a conventional boiler. Now, producer Nicola Dowling is with me. Nicola was with me when we visited the Myattsfield estate in South London. And although, Nicola, it has been rebranded the Oval Quarter, and there are lots of expensive private flats and houses now on the estate, as well as social housing, a lot of the people we spoke to there could ill afford to pay bills that they're not expecting.
Yeah, you're right. As you've said, there's a real mix of people down on the estate there. Half of them, that's around 500, are social housing tenants, and the other half are in private housing. Let's face it, though, no one wants a massive bill they're not expecting. But if you're on a low income, if you're out of work, if you're relying on a pension, it can be devastating and really stressful. And there were loads of people down there that wanted to share their stories with us. And I honestly don't think that residents were exaggerating when they said that some were choosing between heating and eating.
Yeah, and some of the bills people told us about were really puzzling. We spoke to one woman whose heating and hot water were disconnected 18 months ago because she hadn't paid her bill, yet she is still being charged for it every month, despite being unable now to even have a shower.
I haven't had none for a year and a half now. So I carry water from the kitchen, put it in a bucket, boil it on the stove and then tip it in the bath.
That's how you have a bath.
That's how I have a bath.
And Terry, here's your latest bill showing quite clearly 1 month charges for heat, £72.96, VAT on top as well. I'm just puzzled. You've been without heat supplied by the district heating scheme, but you've still got a monthly charge for heating.
And every time I have to phone them up, it costs me money to phone them up and that, and all I get is a sorry and we'll reduce it. But then give it a couple of months, they start adding money on the bill again. It even states on the bill, disconnected. So if I'm disconnected, am I paying for my neighbours? Maybe I should give them a knock and ask them for a shower. I don't know.
And are you worried that you're building up debt as well as the practical problem?
It's not only the debt, it's my credit rating as well. You know, I'm living off £140 a fortnight right now, and it's killing me.
That was Terry O'Keefe, who is still getting bills, even though she's been disconnected for the last 18 months. And she has got an electricity supply to her flat. Nicola, she showed us, didn't she, how she is having to fill up buckets from her kettle and carry them upstairs.
No mean feat.
In order to have some kind of body wash. Incredible stuff. What have Eon had to say about her case?
Well, they said that a failure in the system was to blame for those estimated bills, and they've assured us that they've now sorted that out.
And as we were on the estate, a lady called Jan approached us, said her estimated bills were four times higher than normal. This has suddenly started happening to her. What's their explanation for that?
Well, they said they've also addressed Jan's problems. And Sharon, the lady with the £1,000 bill, they said that had been caused by a fault with the system too, which meant that she hadn't been charged for nearly a year. They said they've halved her debt and offered her compensation. And we asked them about Tina's bills too, but they didn't come back to us with any information on her case.
And a lot of residents were concerned about an elderly gentleman on the estate who died last October called Edward Connell. He had, prior to his death, been extremely concerned about his ability to pay his bills under the district heating scheme.
Yes, so we asked about that case as well. And in a statement, they told us it was a very sad case, but that there was no insight into the wider circumstances of his death. They said they'd spoken to him on a number of occasions. The last time was in June when he provided a meter reading and it was confirmed that he was in credit on his account.
OK, but there's a bigger issue, isn't there, with Eon here. What have they said about this bigger problem about estimated bills being significantly in excess of what people might reasonably expect? Heating breakdowns as well, 48 times in 4 years.
Well, they admitted that they had a number of issues at Myattsfield, and a lot of them were during the initial construction phase of the project. They said they'd apologised to residents and had improved their service to customers. We've also seen an apology letter which was sent out to all residents in February this year after a public meeting on the estate. That letter said the residents' stories had been concerning and humbling to hear. They admitted they'd fallen short of their goal to offer great customer service when people needed help.
OK, so in that case, then a pretty frank admission by Eon that they'd got a lot wrong. But we're talking so far, Nicola, about this one estate. But as we've heard as well, the government is keen to push this scheme much more widely.
Yes, they are. At the moment, more than 200,000 people rely on district heating, but the government wants around 20% of heat to come from district heating systems by 2050 to help us meet our carbon reduction targets. The government call it central heating for cities, and they're investing £320 million in start-up funding, and this is to try and encourage more district heating networks to be built across England and Wales.
Yeah, we're supposed to be economical. That's one of the big selling points, is it? Although some of the bills that we've heard about from people on that estate were astronomical rather than economical. How much cheaper is it supposed to be than conventional heating?
Well, that government funding was announced last year with a promise that it could help reduce energy bills by up to 30%. The Department for Business of Energy and Industrial Strategy made quite a play of that on the website.
Yeah, it's interesting stuff. I had an email in as we're talking from Yogesh, who lives on an estate in East London, which has district heating. He's been spent a bill for the maintenance of the service of the boiler there. £17,000 is Yogesh's share of that bill, which, given that it's presumably a shared district heating unit, does seem incredibly high. Charles Montlake lives on the New Capital Key estate in Greenwich in South London, which has district heating, also run by E.ON. And Natasha Howe, who lives on the Fitzwilliam estate in Rotherham in South Yorkshire, which has district heating provided by the local council. Charles, Natasha, good morning to you both.
Good morning.
And Charles, you took E.ON to court. Tell us why.
Well, I pay the bills for my flat and for my mother's flat, which is next door. According to my calculations, if we'd had gas boilers in the flat, that would have cost me around about £511. But with district heating, we actually paid £1,365.
Wow. So the government's estimating that district heating can save 30% on your heating bills, but you reckon you were paying three times more than you ought to have been.
Well, that's right, yes.
And you went to the small claims court with this, yeah?
Yeah. In July last year, I took E.ON to the small claims court, but I didn't get the chance to prove my case because they settled out of court before. So they gave me £669.
Ah, so you didn't get the chance to examine your claim in court, as it were, but nevertheless the company did send you compensation. Has that had any ongoing effect, though, on the level of your bills? I mean, given that you're tied into district heating, are you still paying the inflated bills, as you would see it, compared to the lower bills if you had your own boiler?
It's had no effect at all, because once they paid me for my flat, I asked them if they'd use the same formula for my mother's flat next door, and they refused, so we're back to court.
Ah, OK, so you're not letting this one go. We heard as well about power failures, outages on the Myatt's North estate. What's your experience of that been in Greenwich?
Well, definitely not as bad as Myatt's North, but we did have an occasion where we lost heat for over 24 hours, and those people who complained immediately were offered compensation, but then suddenly they went, oh, no, it wasn't 24 hours, it was less. And I think that's because they realised that £30 per person on compensation, that was going to cost them the best part of 30 grand if they paid everybody.
Let me bring in Natasha from Rotherham. What's your story, Natasha? How long have you had district heating?
I've had district heating since September 2016 when I moved onto a council estate.
And as I understand it, that has been the kind of the basic heating system for the estate for many years, yes?
Yeah, it has. That's always been that estate. When I first took the property, they said the heating is a little bit expensive, but during the summer you don't use your heating. And obviously winter it can be a little bit more expensive, so I didn't think nothing of it when I took it off the council until I moved in.
And what's the problem been then?
I lived there since, like I said, end of September last year. And I've put £908 on my meter because we're on pay-as-you-go meters, so we don't get bills. It is a card. You just go and top up. And my monthly usage ranges from about 120 up to 200 a month.
So far, far higher than you would have been expecting.
Far higher. My last property, which were private rented, I'd both made gas and electric via E.ON, paid a set amount every month, worked out my gas usage for the 11 month I lived there, and it was £358.
People will be scratching their heads again, as I am listening to your story, Natasha. You know, we've got this big government push towards district heating. We are told that it could save bills by up to 30%, and yet you and Charles and the other people we're hearing from all facing bills significantly in excess of what you've previously paid.
It's not even just the bills as well. If you think about it, we lose out on dual fuel and things like that by having gas and electric, where you company together. I've just had a smart meter fitted and from electric, and on with British Gas, you can get free electric on a Saturday or a Sunday between 9 and 5. I'm not eligible for that because I can't have my gas with them.
Ah, so we're in this situation again then where you're kind of, because you're tied into district heating, you can't get some of the benefits that other people who can sort out their own energy suppliers can get.
That's it. So like I say, I've gone from paying, I think I paid on £78 a month, and it did go down to about 60, 64, and then to my gas bill being about 120, and then my electric on top, which is about £40. That's how much my monthly bill is. Now, the council said, well, during the summertime, still top up your meter about £20, £25, but I shouldn't have to top it up £100 in the summer.
Natasha, good luck to you. Thank you. Natasha Howe in Rotherham. Also heard from Charles Montlake in Greenwich in South London. Nicola Downing, our reporter on this. Firstly, Charles' case, then. What have Ian had to say about that?
Well, they didn't comment on his out-of-court settlement directly, but they did say that they thought his heat was value for money, so make of that what you will.
And as we heard from him, his battle is continuing, isn't it? He's
going
to take them to court again. What about Natasha's bills, and what did Rotherham Council have to say about that?
Well, the council told us they had been made aware that some tenants had been overcharged. They said they've apologised and given refunds. They said they'll be reviewing the unit charge on the estate where she lives and all the other district heating schemes they have. And they say a change in charges going forward would require a council decision, and they're unable to prejudge that at the moment, but they do expect that costs will come down.
OK, Nicola, thank you. We will have more on this story to come. And also, between now and 12 o'clock, tool thefts from vans. We'll have the latest figures obtained exclusively by this programme, and stories too from tradespeople whose livelihoods have been put at risk by a key that you can buy online, anyone can buy it, for 20 quid.
This is BBC Five Live, available on the BBC iPlayer radio app. Five Live Investigates.
Yes, Adrian Goldberg with you here on Five Live Investigates. This morning, the cleaner, greener heating system meant to reduce energy bills, but which residents who use it have been telling us has led to higher charges and power cuts, leaving them cold, without hot water. In some cases, estimated monthly bills have been running into hundreds of pounds. We're talking about something called district heating. Getting your comments on this. Also got Dr. Stuart Hodkinson with us from Leeds University. Stuart, this is coming from Guy. He says, I'm the chair of a small council estate in London. The local council want to upgrade the local communal heating network by building a green district heating power plant built with a government grant. The council have provided a cost-benefit analysis to support the claim that this is a cheaper option over 40 years compared to installing individual combi boilers. It contains a series of basic errors and wildly inaccurate figures. We believe this to be a scandal, and if this pattern is being repeated across the country, it may be a national scandal, says Guy.
Yes, so that's a really interesting point about how the kind of long-term costs are being calculated and then shown to be beneficial in the present. So this is exactly what happened on Mansfield North and Overall Quarter. What's happening is that the long-term costs, the 40-year costs of the infrastructure, the energy plant, the boilers, all the infrastructure that's needed, are kind of being packaged together in very, very untransparent ways, and then are being kind of put into residents' bills. And we are unable to see in the tariff, in the kind of unit price and the service charge, how those costs are being placed onto homeowners and tenants. So there's a real issue here of transparency. We need full transparency of those bills and those costs over the 40 years.
Well, talking of transparency, I want to bring in a moment a kind of an industry voice, but let me just put this one other point to you, Stuart. This is from David in Woking. He says, the biggest problem with district heating is aligned to the long-term procurement of suppliers. They have to recover the cost of building and maintenance of the centre in their energy supply costs. Therefore, the user pays. Long-term agreements mean that service quality is of zero relevance to the suppliers. They're concerned only about return on investment. The consumers are not in their business plans. Again, that was something you identified at Mites North, which is, if you don't like it, you can't get out of it.
No, that's right. But I think what we've also seen on Mansfield North and Overall Quarter is that so many people are complaining and going in public, Facebook, social media, they are going on the radio like this morning. They're making this a very toxic issue now. And so E.ON and other providers, their reputation and their almost like their fitness to be able to take government money and take these contracts in the long term is now in question. So I think the more that people start to bring these issues to the fore, that will actually, they do care about their brand, they do care about their reputation, and they do, and investors in the future will look at them and think, we're not going to touch these companies if they can't get these systems right.
Okay, stay there with us if you would. I should say we did ask the government to comment on this story because there is a government push to encourage more of these kind of schemes, but they said they can't because we are in the run-up to an election. Tim Rotheray is the director of the trade body for district heating suppliers, the Association of Decentralised Energy. Good morning, Tim.
Good morning.
We've heard some pretty scathing views of district heating this morning. What would you say about what we've heard so far?
I suppose the first thing to say is that any of these complaints and concerns that are raised by customers are worrying. And it is always deeply concerning to hear that customers are not happy with district heating. We've actually been aware that there are issues with district heating, and we as an industry have been working to set up schemes to address the issues, the kinds of issues that you've been raising, for the last 4 years. The industry knows that if district heating is going to thrive and going to succeed, it is absolutely vital that the customers that are being served by district heating are content with the service that they're getting and feel that they're being fairly treated. We know that there are some instances where that's not happening, and that's why we've been doing the work that we have over the last 4 years.
Sure, and people will understand the benefit, potentially anyway, of having a centralised heating plant which feeds every flat and house on an estate, and the fact that you don't have separate, potentially inefficient boilers. You know, we all get that. But if, for whatever reason, you don't like your supplier or you have an issue with them, how can it be right that you can't change supplier or that you can't bring in Ofgem, the energy regulator, to make some kind of ruling?
You're absolutely right to identify that as a key issue, and it's something that we've identified as well. As an industry, we have found that there are two areas where we are not allowed by law to set rules, and that's on pricing and on contract length. And because we found that, and because we considered that to be an issue, we, in March, announced a new piece of work that we're doing, which is going to happen over the next 6 months, and we'll report by the end of the year. And that is to say, what is the role of increasing competition and introducing regulation in the sector? And we're going to look at all of those areas and make a recommendation to government, and we have invited the government and the regulator to be observers of that work and to attend the meetings and observe them so that we can actually explore this issue, because it's something that the industry on its own is not able to do. We've identified it, we think it's an issue, and we're working on it.
Could you point us to examples of district heating schemes where there is 100% satisfaction?
I can certainly point you to examples of district heating schemes where things are really going well. So just by example, in Aberdeen, the district council there has put in a heat network. They've taken customers off expensive electric heating. They've reduced the cost of fuel there for those customers by half, and they've cut the carbon emissions on those estates as well by 45%. There's another one in Islington where there's a scheme there that 850 homes are served, and it's expanding to another 450. They've cut the heating cost by 10% and the CO2 emissions there by 60%. So there are some good stories. I've got others that are available.
OK, no, well, thank you for that. Let me ask Stuart Hoggins from Leeds University. Stuart, people have been getting in touch with us as well, talking about the difference between heat trust, that might be run by local councils or by non-profit groups, compared to those run by energy companies. Is there any evidence to suggest that they are better for consumers, or is there a fundamental problem here with district heating schemes?
No, I don't think there's a fundamental problem with district heating schemes. I think, I don't have any evidence in front of me to talk about the comparison between the two, but I think that where you've got big commercial operators that have the power effectively to set prices and to have like a 40-year untouchability, that's a problem. They're not accountable. E.ON and others are not accountable locally. The local authorities are accountable. So if you've got local authorities and social landlords directly involved in the provision, and they can be held to account in a much more you know, useful way than a big powerful energy company. So I think what we've got to do is get a model that is more local, that it's got accountable, democratically elected elements in there, and give residents themselves a major role, a constitutional role, in monitoring the contracts. And if, after 5 years, performance has been very poor, there should be a break clause and they should be able to get out and someone else has to come in and be the provider.
Stuart, thanks for your time this morning. Dr. Stuart Hodkinson from Leeds University. Before that as well, we heard from Tim Rotherer, who's the director of the trade body for district heating suppliers, the Association of Decentralised Energy. Tim, thank you as well. The time now is 11:45.
Take 5Live on the go. On digital, online, smartphone and tablet. 5Live investigates.
Now on 5Live Investigates, the thieves who've declared war on Britain's army of white van men and women. We're talking about plumbers, builders, carpenters, electricians and the thousands more tradespeople who form the backbone of the British economy and who rely on the tools of their trade to do their job and feed their families. The figures obtained exclusively by this programme show that tools are stolen from a van somewhere in the UK on average every 23 minutes. Now, we asked for information about this kind of crime from all 45 of the country's police forces. Two-thirds of them, 30, replied. And whereas 2 years ago, between them, they had recorded just over 14,000 tool thefts from vans, the latest annual figures to March 2017 show that figure had risen to almost 23,000 thefts, an increase of 62%. So what's going on? Well, we've been told that this spike in vehicle crime is being driven, if you'll pardon the pun, by two new methods. One is known as peel and steal, where a criminal will use their body weight to press inwards against the lower part of a van's side door, whilst at the same time prising open the top, then making off with whatever they can. And then there's the tib key method, which involves thieves getting hold of a skeleton or tib key used by locksmiths to open a car without violence. Now, the keys are available online for around £20. Anyone can buy them. There are even internet tutorials on how to use them. I've been to meet Spencer Hargrave and Paul Butterfield, two former Castleford Tigers rugby league players who now run Select Builders, a construction firm in West Yorkshire. Both have been victims of tool theft from their vans. So Paul started by showing me how he has beefed up security since.
We've basically got bars strapped to the insides of the back door, so there's no way that they can be peeled, which makes it hard work for us because we can't actually gain access from the outside. And I have to climb in the back, get an hammer, and actually physically knock bars off so that it can gain access.
So you've had to put that iron bar across the middle of the back of your van to prevent peel and steel thefts and prevent tib key thefts.
Peel and steel are the tib key just filed, really.
And you've also got this. What's this?
I've also put alarms on the side doors, so if anyone tries to gain access, as soon as it breaks a contact, as you'll find out, it's a loud noise.
And how frustrating is it that the tib key is still available for sale through the internet?
It's really ridiculous, to be honest. We've been fighting the tib key with suppliers for approaching 2 years now. It probably took at least a year just for them to acknowledge that it shouldn't be, and they took them down for maybe 2 weeks, and then they appeared back on again and carry on.
So you could buy one today?
You can buy one today.
So you've got your own tib key, Spencer. Let's just have a look at it.
I've got a tib key that I got off Amazon for £15. No questions asked. Basically take a pin out and put it in the lock and move a few barrels around and it opens the door.
What would you do then about the sale of those keys?
I'd put some regulation on it, some kind of licence system. It can only be sold to locksmiths, genuine locksmiths. That's what their trade is, not just anybody.
And you've had your own problems with break-ins. Well, tell me what happened to you.
I walked out my house one morning, noticed the back door's slightly ajar. I thought, not again. Comes to the van, opens the door, I rung the police. And then they run back and says, there's no point us coming out, it's a builder's van. There'll be no fingerprints. Get yourself to work. Give me a crime number. And that was it, basically. Forgotten about.
How valuable were the tools stolen from your van?
Very valuable. It's what we need to work day in, day out. Without those tools, we haven't got a business at the end of the day.
And again, this skeleton key, a Ford tib key, had been used to gain access to your van pretty easily by the sound of it.
No force needed at all. It's just probably under 30 seconds they're in your van and no sign of braking.
In your case, Spencer, you set about trying to track down the people responsible. Tell me what happened.
Me and Paul, not type of people to rest. We had to find out who it was that did it. And basically, we went round all the local houses and got a load of CCTV together and trawled through hours of CCTV until we actually saw something. They turned round in the car on the driveway of the person that had the CCTV. So luckily, we could get a registration, which traced them back to being an hire car, which he took out in his own name. And it was all part of an organised gang that were breaking into houses for the car keys and sending the cars off to Poland.
Over and above the issue of the TIB keys, this issue of peel and steal has also emerged. Just tell me what peel and steal is.
The thieves come up the side of the side door, a bit of force put in the right areas and the door will just peel down.
Can you understand why the police, at a time of short resources, might not make this a priority and might say, well, look, they're your tools, you can do more to protect them?
I mean, what makes one crime any different to another crime? We're all tradesmen, we're doing our work for the community in building houses, and we need the tools to work. Why isn't that a priority? People have gone out of business due to it.
That's Spencer Hargrave and Paul Butterfield, who now run a van and tool theft awareness campaign on Facebook. Interesting there that Spencer had to track down CCTV footage on his own to bring the person responsible for the break into his van to justice. Paul saying the police just weren't interested at all in solving his crime, just gave him a crime number and told him to get on with it. Now, Deputy Chief Constable Matt Jukes from the National Police Chiefs Council Lead for Acquisitive Crime acknowledged that there has been a rise in theft from vehicles in recent times, but he said this was against the backdrop of a previous decrease in theft rates. And he said, we do investigate these cases and tailor our response to the circumstances and the individual needs of the victim. I wonder if that was the case for Paul Shepherd, a carpenter whose van has been targeted twice already this year. Good morning to you, Paul.
Hiya.
Yeah, welcome. Tell us your story.
Well, the first time I got my van broke into was January the 4th, the first day back of the year, the first working day. And I'd come out to my van, had to go to the suppliers to pick up some materials. And as I loaded the materials into the back of the van, I realised all my power tools had been removed.
And that was in Birmingham, yeah?
Yeah, it was in Birmingham, South Birmingham.
And what was that? Was that a TIB key break-in?
Well, I couldn't tell you. Unfortunately, the area I was working at, there was no CCTV of the area. Mm. It was in broad daylight. It was, you know, sometime between 11:30 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And when I got into my van, I didn't notice anything strange until I went to put the materials in the back of the van, and that's when I noticed all my DeWalt tools, which I'd, you know, spent a long time buying and building up a kit. The lot was gone. I thought it was a bit of a joke at first. I thought one of the lads, you know, I work amongst, had been playing a game with me.
Because it was such a clean robbery.
No sign of any entry at all.
And then you've had another break-in. Tell us about that.
I'd come home from visiting my mum in Devon, my parents, and I saw the van when I went to bed. I got work the next morning. I saw the van. I went to bed at 11:30 that evening. It was quite late. And I think my son told me he saw it at midnight. And at 4 o'clock in the morning, I woke up. And my girlfriend opened the window because I was hot. And she said, Paul, where's the van? At which point I looked out the window and everything was gone. My van was gone. There was just a space where it was. There was no broken glass. There was no sign of, you know, anything untoward. Just the fact that the van was gone.
And we'll talk about the ease with which criminals can steal both vans and the materials from vans and the police response on that in a moment, Paul. But I just want to bring in at this point Andrew Miller, who's Chief Technical Officer at Thatcham Motor Research Centre. Andrew, you know, the ease with which stuff is being taken out of vans is astonishing, isn't it? What can people like Paul and the many other hundreds of thousands of tradespeople around the UK do better to protect themselves?
Well, good morning. Morning. Yes, absolutely. I think there are things that can be done. And it was very interesting to listen to the story of the two guys who'd actually put some come around the inside of their vehicles. You know, you can take further steps, and obviously you can take it to the nth degree. You could put a safe inside your van as well.
I did
at the end of the day,
Paul, you said you did that.
I put a safe in the back of the right. van vaults, bolted to the floor of the van.
Yeah.
So they just took the whole van this time.
Yeah, no, indeed. So there's only so much any of us can do to protect that property. I think a very determined thief is going to steal the van. They could even tow it away and put on a low loader. We've heard of that as well. You know, I think the best thing you can do is lock it up. But of course, these are not comforting words if you've been experiencing it. I think that the reality is that vehicles are, you know, designed to a price. There's only so much can be done. And it's interesting, you know, the comment from Matt Dukes there that the actual reduction over time is significant. I mean, actually, the actual numbers are about a million vehicles were broken into in 92. And in 2015, it was about 200,000. So that's a massive reduction. And 620,000 stolen in 92 and 75,000 in 2015. So you can see from the police's perspective, it's gone down relatively. But of course, if you happen to be the person, you know, who's been subject to this, then, you know, it's your livelihood, it's everything. So,
and if you realise that you can buy a skeleton key, a TIB key, online for £20 or less, that anyone can buy one, that you can get an online tutorial in how to use them, I mean, it's almost an invitation to the criminal fraternity, isn't it, Andrew?
Yes, it is. And your comment earlier on was it's organised crime. The vast majority of this is organised crime. They're gangs. They're really targeting vehicles or individuals who've got, you know, specific, they think there's a rich pickings there. So it unfortunately is organised crime. And I happen to know for a fact that the Met and other metropolitan police forces are doing what they can to get rid of these gangs, and they're quite successful in many cases. But they're a bit like weeds. You know, you get one gang and another one springs up.
And Paul, though, it's kind of made you reconsider your career.
Well, yeah, I've got no confidence. I'm in a position now where I've got no tools. I have no van. I don't know what point I'll have any confidence to go out and replace a van and tools for it to happen a third time. They say lightning doesn't strike twice, but it certainly does. The first time I lost my tools, I thought it was about £3,200, but you keep finding things that were missing. It was about £4,000 worth of tools, which were replaced, and a few more.
What about insurance?
Well, the van was insured, the tools in the back wasn't. I'm still not in a position to be able to just throw money away willy-nilly. I had to rebuild what I'd got, so little things like that was something that was going to be done in time. I didn't really expect to get hit again quite so quickly, but more than anything, to lose 30 years worth of, you know, my kit and everything that I owned has just gone. Yet I still have to pay my bills and provide a home the same as everyone else. Somebody just come and took that away from me.
Listen, Paul, we wish you all the best. Thank you for joining us this morning. That's Paul Shepherd speaking to us this morning from our Birmingham studio. Thanks also to Andrew Miller from the Thatcham Research Centre. In relation to Paul's crime, West Midlands Police told us they can confirm that they have recorded and fully investigated all current lines of inquiry in connection with the report of theft. They say details of the stolen vehicle were immediately placed on the PNC and radioed out for observation. They say, unfortunately, in this instance, there was no CCTV available and a lack of forensic opportunity at the scene. Therefore, it was not proportionate to dispatch officers. And at this stage, there are no further lines of inquiry that we can pursue, they say. Just to say as well, this is the last episode of Five Live Investigates in the current run, but we'll be back in September, 11 o'clock, Sunday mornings. In the meantime, keep your emails coming. We will still be here working hard. Email goldberg@bbc.co.uk, goldberg@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening to the Five Live Investigates podcast. We'll be back again in September. In the meantime, send your emails to goldberg@bbc.co.uk. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to a BBC Five Live podcast.
If you like this, you might also like this.
Flintoff, Savage and the Ping Pong Guy.
Is everybody's hunger in sport different?
I was hungry. I wanted to be the best. For me, you win or that's it.
To find out more about our range of podcasts, click, tap or swipe bbc.co.uk/5live.